You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, May 6, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, author of What's the Matter with Kansas and the Conquest of Cool, Thomas Frank. On the conquest of cool and the commodification of revolution. Also on the program today, Cecily McMillan found guilty of abusing a police officer, 7 years, or up to 7 years a sentence. No sentence as of yet, just a horrible coda on the massive police violence perpetrated against the Occupy movement. Major new climate change report released today by the White House. It's here. We're already being affected by it. New report on what the implications of RomneyCare was in Massachusetts, and perhaps a harbinger of what we can expect from Obamacare. Mortality rates down. And the Supreme Court says it's okay to have sectarian prayers before city council meetings. So get your Jesus on if you want those potholes filled. Ladies and gentlemen,
we are going to begin the Majority Report. We are going to begin the show now with a Muslim call to prayer.
That's right.
Every program. So be ready.
Well, that's actually a different, that's not even analogous.
I know it's not implicated, but I just wanted to sort of say, I think with each pro-public prayer decision, there should be an increase in Muslim prayer in America.
Well, maybe. Maybe we'll see some of that. We will get to other stories as well. I've been meaning to just point out this one. Which is, I know, this is more of like a fun section story. But last week it was reported, I guess 3 weeks ago now, in Denmark, scores of Carlsberg workers, I don't know if you drink Carlsberg beer, walked off their jobs in protest after the Danish brewer tightened their rules on workplace drinking by removing beer coolers from work sites. The new alcohol policy allows them to drink beer only during lunch hours in the canteen. Previously, they could help themselves to beer throughout the day from coolers placed around the work sites. The only restriction at the time was you could not be drunk at work. It was up to everyone to be responsible.
Honor code.
Honor code. 800 workers went on strike, and about 250 walked off their jobs, resulting in interruptions to beer transports around Copenhagen. The truck drivers joined the strike in sympathy, even though they're exempt from the new rules. Truck drivers are permitted to bring 3 beers from the canteen because they often don't have time to lunch there. So you could drink those throughout the day.
Make sure the drivers are exempted from this.
Now, we should know.
Wouldn't want to inconvenience them.
The trucks have alcohol ignition locks preventing the drivers from driving drunk. So, I don't know how quickly those beer deliveries get there, but...
Thankfully, there's no such rule here at the Majority Report.
That's right. Oh, nice work! Wow. Matt! I think that is the best use, that is the best production value I think we've ever had on this show. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Thomas Frank. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Thomas Frank, author of What's the Matter with Kansas, Conquest of Cool, now contributing to Salon.com, also a longtime Harper's writer, the founder of The Baffler, or co-founder. Thomas, welcome.
Yeah, that's me. I did all that stuff.
Well, and now apparently you found time to read the Piketty book.
Well, you know, I have to do that. It's my job, Sam. That's what I do, man.
I
read really long books, so you don't have to.
Well, good. We will talk about that. I'm going to try and see if I can't convince my 8-year-old to let me read it to her for a bedtime story. I don't want to get into a long, protracted argument with her about R greater than G, but we'll see.
Yeah.
So, I read the exchange you had with Lewis Lapham about Revolution. Lapham's Quarterly has a new issue on revolutions, and I want to talk about that. But talk to me a little bit about your response to Piketty's work.
Well, I read it really fast when it first came out, and I thought, man, this is boring. And then I sat down again and read it at a more leisurely pace. And there's several important things about the book. The most important thing is that he, you know, and what the point that everybody has recognized is that the debate over inequality is over. He won. It's happening, and it's happening for these various reasons. You know, it's just completely undeniable. Now, I don't. There are a lot of things about Piketty that I don't agree with. There's an air of sort of almost morbid pessimism about mm-hmm. the book. The idea that this is basically the law of capitalism, and the only thing that's ever interrupted it in history is the two world wars. I know that that's just flat out incorrect. And there's various ways of proving that. For example, the United States, the country we happen to live in, was not badly damaged in either world war. So you can't just say our capital was destroyed in the manner that it was in a place like France or Germany, or even Britain. There's obviously other forces at work. And, he needs to take those into account. But if you think about it, if you think about this giant doorstop of a book as sort of beginning of You know, the first part of the debate is over. Inequality is happening. It's getting worse. It's completely out of control, and there's no denying it. And it's not because, you know, the people on top deserve it or something like that, you know, which is what the conservatives are always saying. So that debate is over. The next debate is what to do about it.
Right.
And that's where it gets really interesting. And I don't think he really has a good answer for that. His answer is pretty fanciful.
Right. That being a an international, a world wealth tax.
Yeah, that's right. A global wealth tax. Yeah, that's impossible. Now, there are wealth taxes. We used to have a massive one here in the United States, the estate tax. And if you go back and look at the history of the estate tax, which I've been doing, you know, when we were debating all this, what was it? Was it 10 years ago now that that the Republicans managed to repeal the estate tax?
Yep.
You remember that?
Yeah, maybe even like 11 or 12. It was the first couple of years of the Bush administration.
Yeah. But if you go back and look at it, Americans were once like keenly enthusiastic for the wealth tax, for the estate tax, excuse me. And one of the reasons they liked it is because, I mean, the reason they liked it is because they didn't like the idea of aristocracy. This is like very deep in the American grain. This is something that a debate that our side could win if we wanted to. There's a whole book about the rise of the estate tax. This is a book, Sam, from 1939.
Right.
About the logic behind the estate tax, and I went and got it and have been reading it. And the things that people said when they, when they were making the estate tax like 80% or whatever they did in the 30s, Franklin Roosevelt basically said, "We're doing this because the idea of aristocracy is reprehensible to Americans." Well, look, that it still is. You know, we haven't changed as a people. We've just been, you know, bamboozled by these right wingers.
Well, specifically, it was Frank Luntz, wasn't it? I mean, wasn't it Frank Luntz who came up with the ethically and follically challenged Frank Luntz who came up with the with the death tax?
Yeah, the death
moniker.
Tax. Yeah, yeah.
And yep. nobody wants to pay a tax up for dying.
No, the idea is, yeah, the idea is reprehensible. It sounds like you have to. It sounds like you know, the medieval Catholic Church, you know, before the Reformation, where you had to pay to get into heaven.
Right.
You know, it sounds like just insanely offensive. It sounds like a theological imposition. It's an outrage. Well, look, a guy like Frank Luntz succeeds, first of all, because he's clever, but second of all, because the other team doesn't beat him.
Right.
We've talked for a long time about these issues, Sam, and you know I always come back to this. One of the reasons that the right wins when they have lousy issues and they have, you know, a lousy way of describing them, and, you know, the only way that their stupid, lousy arguments succeed is because our side doesn't just blast them out of the water, because we don't have a guy like Franklin Roosevelt making this case, in this clear and forthright manner. Instead, we have a bunch of dithering, you know, Democrats in Washington, D.C., Bill Clinton, Barack Obama. I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself here. I get really mad at these guys. You know that.
Yes.
But this is an argument that our side could win if we had the right leadership. There's no question in my mind.
You know, I'll tell you, the biggest twist on that argument that I have encountered in terms of the estate tax, I was on Chris on the Chris Hayes' weekend show on Up a couple of years ago with a guy who was on the President Obama's finance committee. He was formerly a Republican, an African American man. For the life of me, I can't remember his name. Peebles, I guess it was. And the argument that we had that took place, I think a lot of it happened actually off air, was that for African Americans, it's the only way to build wealth would be to reduce the estate tax. Now, I didn't know it at the time. I found out after I got off the program. He was listed as one of Forbes' wealthiest African Americans in the country. And his argument was that we can't, we have no way of passing wealth on and building wealth in the African American community if it weren't for repealing the estate tax. And of course,
well,
you know,
but you can always adjust it so that it doesn't affect, you know,
or you could just not worry about the infinitesimally small amount of people, never mind African American, but are also white, who are subject to the estate tax. We're talking about less than a percentage point, I think, maybe.
But that's an interesting argument that the guy made. I've never heard that one before. But it sounds like, I mean, these things are always based on misconceptions. The idea that he's suggesting is that the government takes everything from everybody, and that's just not the case. The proposal.
Well, he's arguing they're going to take it from me, is basically what his argument was.
Well, that could be. I don't know anything about this guy. But remember, they said the same thing about family farmers, that the estate tax is killing the family farm, and it's doing nothing of the kind. You know, and we do, the family farm is dying. We know why it's dying, and the estate tax has nothing to do with it. So they get hold of a very real, you know, anxiety, you know, the death of the family farm, or the problems of the black family, and then attach this completely unrelated, objection to it. Very typical.
And the other aspect, I mean, that's on the table that Piketty doesn't really, pay enough attention to, at least in the context of this country, was sort of the relationship between government and unions. And
yes, that's exactly right. Now you're hitting it. He doesn't talk about unions at all in the book. I could not believe this, and I've read the whole thing, 600 pages. He talks about them in the first sentence. Or the first, I should say, paragraph. He talks about a strike in South Africa, and he returns to that strike in the last paragraph of the book, and that's it. Other than that, he doesn't mention it at all. Now, it could be he's very France-focused. This is one of his blind spots. He's very focused on France and, to a certain degree, the UK, and to a lesser degree, Germany. But America, he doesn't understand at all. And he doesn't know, apparently doesn't understand what a enormous political issue organized labor is in the United States, and how dramatically organized labor sort of remade the economic landscape in this country. You know, that's when you talk about the changes from the 30s up to the 70s, labor was both, you know, causing the changes and also building the political constituency for the changes.
Right.
I mean, its role is a historical role was enormous, and he doesn't address it at all. So now you're coming close to what I'm writing about next week for Salon. So I have to stop talking about it now. But
no, I understand. I don't want to.
You're going to give away my story,
right? I don't want to step on. I want to keep the air in the tires, as it were. But let's turn to your conversation with Lapham. And I have to say that it's been years since I've read Conquest of Cool, and I am now determined to reread it because. I'm fascinated and not just because, of course, you know, like,
have you seen the TV show?
Well, that's the thing, is I'm watching Mad Men and it's coming to life there.
Yeah. But, no, it's a joke. I'm just kidding. They've never contacted me. It has, you know.
Well, you know, it occurred to me. I don't understand why you're not. But tell us about, give us a thumbnail of Conquest of Cool so we can start from there. Because this is a book about sort of absorbing in many respects and commodifying to the extent that we had any type of revolutionary fervor, I guess, in the 60s.
Yeah. Any kind of revolutionary impulse. And it's not like a political trick. It's not like, you know, some diabolical scheme that the capitalists of America figured out sitting around a table somewhere. So I came to the subject, I was, you know, it was the 90s. I was deeply involved in punk rock. And admittedly, I have a strange past, and it's a strange way of coming to a subject, but, you know, that's what happened. And punk rock was at the time, in the early 90s, was being packaged up, you know, remember they called it alternative, and it was becoming a very mainstream thing. And I was watching this happen, and I was sort of fascinated by it in a kind of, or I should say horrified by it, by what was happening. And I became very interested in the phenomenon of, you know, how things go from being radical or revolutionary or whatever, adversarial is the word. Things go from being politically adversarial to being mainstream, being, you know, a lifestyle that you go down and buy at Walgreens or something. And the it led me back to the 1960s, you know, the original case of this, you know, the sort of counterculture of the 60s and how that became a product, you know, went from being something genuine to being a product. And so I decided, so I was also in graduate school, right? I was studying history, and I decided I would write about, instead of writing about the youth culture itself, I would write about the co-opters. I would write about the advertising industry. So this was my idea. So it's a study of the advertising industry in the 50s and 60s, and try to understand America, you know, the decade of you know, dramatic change, the 1960s, through the eyes of the advertising industry. So that was my idea, and that's what The Conquest of Cool is about. And the title sort of gives it away, gives away a conclusion, you know, what happened. Cool was conquered by the advertising people. And they didn't do it. Like I said, it wasn't a conspiracy. It wasn't like they were trying to stave off political change or something like that. A lot of advertising people tend to be pretty much on the left politically. You know, they tend to have pretty good politics. But they did it for reasons of their own. They came to youth culture and embraced youth culture and loved youth culture for reasons of their own, having more to do with sort of the debates going on in the business world than anything having to do with politics. Do you want to hear the rest of the story?
Yeah, I do. Going? I just, let me interject something though, because the thing that sort of fascinates me is I was a former Situationist International fetishist for a while. And I don't know if you're familiar with Guy Debord.
Yeah, Adbusters.
Yeah, well, but
yeah, were you going to say Guy Debord?
Guy Debord, and
yeah, I read that guy. That was when I was writing this book. I read that guy.
And
Society
he,
of the
yes,
Spectacle.
And exactly, and in fact, the Sex Pistols were sort of developed along this notion of the Situationists in some way, where you build in the critique. And Guy Debord wrote in a way that I think I probably understood only about 20% of it when I read it, but was very much about the commodification of human emotion and sort of absorbing this stuff and processing it and then regurgitating it. And it's a similar process of what you're talking about in terms of what the and he of course wrote this stuff in the 60s, and many attribute what happened in 68 in France to you know, a half a dozen Situationists going around and putting up some posters about dissent and whatnot. But this notion of the of society and you know, the, I guess the analogy or the sort of the handmaiden is sort of the advertising, the mechanism in which to fuel capitalism, absorbing emotions and spirit and then sort of processing them and pumping them back out in a more sort of digestible way.
Yeah, that's right. That, yes, and that's a good description of what happens and happens and happens and keeps happening. All the time. The fascinating thing is why they do it, and that's what The Conquest of Cool was about, was why they do it. And like you know, like my other books, I try to harness that story, that sort of larger, you know, intellectual story, the theoretical story, with the sort of mundane story of the advertising industry itself, you know. And so I read all of those books, and I interviewed a whole bunch of advertising people. I actually spent a lot of time in the offices of several agencies who gave me access to their files. It was really interesting. And this is what I concluded finally is that, you know, why did these ad men love youth culture in the 60s? And they did. You understand? They were absolutely in love with the counterculture, and they were in love with it from a very early date. Not, you know, they had developed a kind of phony counterculture in their own minds before the real one even came on the scene. They just sort of theoretically made it up. You know, it was something very different, but they were, you know, the idea of you know, idealistic rebel youth was something that they believed in even before it happened. Huh. You know, And so, you know, so I'm wondering about why they did this. What motivated them to embrace the counterculture in this kind of almost embarrassing way that they did? You know, they loved it so much. They were so idealistic about it. You know, much more idealistic than actual participants were.
In dealing with advertising people today, or, you know, to the extent that I did, you know, back when I was more in the entertainment field, and, you know, I would be brought in to do voiceovers or whatnot, they all seem to be sort of like alternative comedy fans. You know, this is back in the 90s.
Yeah.
And there was almost like a sense of, you know, they were all, I guess, frustrated comedians or wanted to find
their artistic quality.
Monkey. Yes. And so
the industry is filled with that, with people like that, artists monkey.
And they would gravitate towards the edgiest stuff in some way as a way of, I guess, you know, sort of supplementing or supplicating that sense that they were stifling it. In themselves.
So the advertising industry has a vision of themselves that they'll tell you about, you know, when they go to congressional hearings and they're being investigated or something like that, and they say, we're just a mirror. We're just a reflection of society. And that's not the case at all. It's not true at all. They have their own agenda. They have their own reasons for doing things. But the reasons aren't the sort of grand political conspiracies that some people imagine. But like you said, I mean, they tend to be fans of edgy comedy, edgy art, literature. They wanted to, most, you know, I would often meet people that wanted to be novelists or film producers or whatever, or actors themselves. And so they have their own, you know, their own reasons for gravitating towards what they do, you know. But it's always youth culture. It's always rebel youth culture, even when they're selling Cadillacs. Even when they're selling Cadillacs to old people. You know, and remember the Cadillac a few years ago where they were selling it with the Led Zeppelin?
Well, have you seen that most recent Cadillac commercial?
Okay, but that is old people now, I guess, Led Zeppelin.
But have you seen the most recent Cadillac commercial with the
No, I don't watch TV anymore. That's
well,
my problem.
I mean, you should look this one up on YouTube. It's a guy, you know, sort of a, I guess, a middle-aged guy who is talking about why America is so great as opposed to, let's say, France, for instance. And it's basically because we work ourselves to death. We are mean, lean machines. And then he actually plugs in his fully electric Cadillac. It's a bizarre ad. And Ford actually did one in response. But in both instances, and even in the response, which I appreciated, again, it's that sort of absorbing this sort of notion of not being a money-making machine to actually make money. And it's
okay, so this is you're describing a sort of one of the classic kind of polarities in the advertising world. So this is one of the sort of grand theories of advertising, is that it fluctuates over time between two symbolic poles. And one symbolic pole is counterculture, you know, what I described, and the other is efficiency, that you buy products because they make you more efficient, or they're a badge of efficiency, and they show what a hard worker you are, or they help you work. And so they've actually, you can trace this in like Coca-Cola advertising, where Coke will go from, you know, being the real thing, you know, the authenticity business, mm-hmm. to then being what is it? They had an ad campaign at some point where Coke helped you work harder. Geez, I'm forgetting what the slogan was now. Things go better with Coke,
right?
You know, and they go back and forth, right? And Pepsi does the same thing. It's the Pepsi generation, classic sort of countercultural approach. And then they did the Pepsi challenge. Remember where Pepsi is like scientifically proven to be tastier than Coke, but they always move in. It's like the Earth and the Moon. You know, they're always rotating around each other, Coke and Pepsi. But Ford and Cadillac, I never thought of that. That's really.
Oh yeah, no, you got to you can Google those and find those ads. And but let's talk about a little bit about what happened with with the idea of revolution. I mean, when I think of like sort of the absorption of the counterculture, and I think I don't know that we really have a counterculture anymore. I mean, we definitely have subcultures, but none that seem to have a distinct sort of reward system that is not tied into capitalism anymore. I mean, this has been
a long-running
theme.
But it's also, at the same time, it's so easy to, you know, go out and get a tattoo and listen to really, really outrageous, you know, alt-rock. And, you know, you just turn on the radio and there it is. It's so easy to become part of an alternative subculture. It's just, there's no challenge to it. It has no political content. And it's everywhere. I mean, if you aren't part of, you know, you have to be hip. You have to be cool nowadays. If you aren't, I mean, you're some kind of incredible loser.
And commercial none of these cultures seem
I
to
am
be.
An, I am an incredible loser. I don't know if I ever told you this, Sam. I'm like the world's biggest, you know, loser. So.
Well, you and I have our own club here. But none of it seems to be counter anymore. I mean, you know, this was a phenomenon I feel like I you know, first noticed with independent film in the early 90s, that for a while it existed, but then it was simply a mechanism in which you would make money at Sundance. You know, and Sundance actually moved from being a place where you could see movies that were not, were almost like specifically not commercially viable in some way, to this was the best way to become commercially viable.
Yeah,
and that all
right.
seemed
well,
to
happened,
change.
That's happened all over the place. Think of South by Southwest. When I was a punk rocker, South by Southwest was, you know, where that it was a get together of people who were really on the fringe of the music industry. You know, it was a lot of bands putting out their own records and stuff like that. Look at it today. They have a tech conference associated with it, you know?
So what happened? I mean, was that a function of, I mean, was that a function, was it advertising that essentially sort of so much absorbed the counterculture to the point where it sort of made the concept obsolete in some way?
Yeah, but it's not just advertising. It's the business culture generally. Came around to this. Advertising is at the cutting edge. You've got to remember that when you were describing the ad men that you met back in the day, what you're describing are the intellectuals of the business world. You know, these are the people who are ahead of the curve, ahead of the game, and they are thinking out the problems long before, you know, the office park management company in Kansas City is thinking out the problems. The advertising people have doped them out, and you know, it's like the university or the think tank or something like that. That's what they are. That's their one of their functions, one of their many functions in the business world. And the big problem in the business world back in the 50s, to get back to the conquest of cool here, the big problem in the business world was conformity. This was, you know, this was the thing that everybody was worried about in the 50s. You go back and read The Organization Man, which I don't know if you remember this, started as a series in Fortune magazine. I mean, nobody remembers that, but that's what it was. It was a business book about business problems. And the problem was that conformity was killing innovation, or that was the fear. I don't know if it was true or not, but there's an enormous literature on this in the 50s, you know, of management people and other people, advertising people, writing about the problem with business. That was the problem. And when they saw something like the counterculture coming along, they understood it as the solution to their problem. And by the way, and this problem could be elaborated out over all sorts of different fields, like workers no longer were, taking any kind of chances, inventors weren't inventing, and consumers were also not consuming at their peak because they were such conformists. They all wanted to buy the same stuff. Conformity was, you know, we always think of conformity as the way consumerism works, but a lot of these ad men in the 60s thought conformity was a problem. You had to overcome conformity. Now, why is that? It's actually really simple. You've got, you know, think about it in Coke versus Pepsi. Coke is this dominant brand, you know, But all the other soda pops in America want people to stop drinking
right.
brand, right? They want you to stop being a conformist and take a chance with 7-Up or something like that, you know?
The Un-Cola, I guess that
yeah,
was.
Yeah, you see what I'm getting at?
Yes,
you just got it there.
And so
exactly.
It's just a mechanism in which to be able to roll out new brands and new consumer
yeah, that's
products.
Right. Exactly. So it's planned obsolescence. So we know that planned obsolescence is how something like GM used to work in the old days. And it's sort of now a principle for society in general that things get culturally obsoleted, even if they're not technologically obsoleted. And we just roll on buying more and more and more. Now, I should say, Sam,
I want to add that is what the concept of revolution is, right? I mean,
yeah,
it's a
exactly.
revolution in
now
soda.
You
now
yeah.
your cola is actually you can see through it, and
yeah.
that's what is.
Do you remember Zima? Do you remember that?
Of course. Are you kidding?
Yeah, in the 90s. And do you remember there was an there was an effort to launch a kind of alt-rock soda. What was it called?
Oh. Thomas? Oh, we lost him. We'll be right back, folks.
It was so punk.
Someone had to stop that interview. There's too much counterculture talk going on. The system can't handle this interview.
All right, so the alt-rock soda.
Yeah, it was called OK. OK
soda.
That. It didn't last long. It wasn't a success. But it's just there, you know, the world of brands and consumer products is littered with failures, but that was one of them. But there are other ones that are successful. The 7-Up, my favorite, just because the ads were so colorful, was the 7-Up campaign in the late 60s, the Un-Cola.
And they had the glass that was upside down, right? I mean, like
I have one of those around. So, well, you can get those at thrift stores just about anywhere. They just scattered them all over the nation. And they also they had these Peter Max-inspired ads that were really amazing. I mean, they wouldn't have been out of place at Woodstock, you know. And you still see them. Oddly enough, the place where you see them is like when you're in small towns that time has forgot. You know, somebody will have one of these signs over their the gas station or the drugstore or something like that still to this day. I saw one just the other day.
Well, so how has this played into our politics? Because I feel like at this time where the counterculture was subsumed, there was a lot of other things happening, including, you know, the first credit cards, frankly. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, there was a growing sense in the 70s and perhaps into the 80s, but certainly more so in the 80s and even in the early 90s about income inequality. And, you know, I came across a video snippet of David Halverson talking about how, like, in the early 90s and talking about, like, you know, Morton Downey Jr.'s program is an example of how the middle class is, you know, feeling this pinch. And he's, you know, the people on Morton Downey Joe
yeah.
show,
well,
they don't realize
common,
what's going on, but they,
yeah,
they
that was a common, common sort of refrain in the early 90s. We'll talk about that in a moment, but let me go back to originally what you said. What's the political impact of everything I've been saying? And it's, you know, there's no direct political impact. You know, this is something that I'm describing happening in the business world, but in the larger abstract terms, there's something very noticeable, which is our consumer culture becomes more radical and even revolutionary, like dramatically so, to the point today where it's, you know, the kind of advertising I'm describing from the 60s is in your face all the time. It's there all the time. You know, fake youth cultures are being invented constantly. My kids watch something called the Disney Channel, you know, on cable TV. It's much more, you know, cool and radical and hipper than anything I ever did as a punk rocker. You know, the Disney Channel, okay? So our commercial culture has become insanely radicalized at the same sort of historical moment that our politics have become bland, have become nothing. You know, well, you think about the big political change of the last 30 years is, on the one hand, the Republicans moving to the right, but the Democrats flying the white flag. And, you know, this is what makes Bill Clinton so significant and the Democratic Leadership Council. They essentially give in on economic issues. You just don't have a choice. Let's say you don't like free trade treaties, Sam. Right. Let's say you don't like NAFTA. Who are you going to vote for?
Ross Perot, I guess, if I can go back in time.
Yeah, you don't have a choice, buddy. Let's say, you know, you want national health care. You don't want like something like you don't want to be, you know, forced to buy private insurance. You want the real deal. Where's your choice? No, I mean, you can go down the list. You know, when Barack Obama said he agreed with Mitt Romney on Social Security, you know,
right.
that used to be the defining issue for Democrats. That cut to who they were as their identity, okay? But those changes have been drained out. I mean, the differences, the distinction, the brand distinctions have, you know, been drained out of our politics, or at least on one side, on the Democratic side.
Well, so what is the relationship between those two things? I mean, is it just sort of coincidental that it happened almost, you know, more or less?
Well, there's another angle here that I'm not really getting into. You know, consider that I wrote The Conquest of Cool, and then a few years later I wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, and that is the degree to which radical, revolutionary, alternative, whatever you want to call it, commercial culture spawned a political backlash. Okay? And it did. It did have, you know, obviously the hippies and the whole 60s thing drove middle Americans crazy.
Right.
And, you know, when I wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, you know, you read right-wing literature, you talk to right-wingers, you talk to conservatives, and they'll always, at some point, the conversation will turn to how disgusted they are by what's on TV and how disgusted they are by what's in the movies. And they always say things like, why don't they listen to us? Why don't they make movies that we like? Why don't they, you know, blah, 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 blah. And there's a real good reason for that, because they aren't about mirrors. They aren't about reflecting you. They're about their own agenda. They're about selling something to you. You know, even Hollywood has its own agenda. It's an industry that thinks in an industrial way, that thinks, you know, has its own intellectuals and its own reasons for doing everything. And the right can never understand this. And so they look out at this world of offensive culture, you know, this world is constantly telling you what a loser you are and how lame you are, as I confessed earlier that I am. This world that's constantly reminding you of how uncool you are and how much cooler the people are who drink 7-Up or whatever it is, you know. Constantly telling you this in 100 tiny ways every day. And there is a political backlash to it. And so it's no surprise to me that while, you know, radicalism has moved into commercial culture, reaction has, you know, taken over our politics. So one party just gives up, and the other party just goes spinning off into this, you know, land of crazy, you know, traditional values, family values, you know, insane free market fundamentalism on down the line.
Well, I get
these things are all connected in some grand way.
Yeah, I mean, I get the part about, you know, sort of, The culture has moved away from the identification, you know, sort of the touchstones of the right. I get that aspect of it. But the part that I think is even, to me, is even more interesting is this notion of of how the conquest of cool in some way also inhibited the, I guess, the it quashed the counterculture and inhibited those set of values that surrounding money, or it made money ascendant in such a way that it completely mitigated any movement on the left. In other words, that like because money became so ascendant and there was no counterculture that wasn't almost immediately absorbed and maybe even before it existed, commodified yeah. in some way, where money became an ascendant value within every other culture. So while hip hop even or any of the music, it became, you know, it's now we don't even talk about the idea.
The things that were once so central to alternative culture, which is adversarialism, like I said earlier, you know, this criticism of capitalism. You think about punk rock. I mean, that's what it was all about. You know, it was criticism of capitalism in general and of the music industry in particular. You know, there was we were swimming in that this hatred of the music industry, and that's all disappeared. You know, once it becomes commodified, you know, obviously that stuff goes. But
I don't think I've read or heard anyone say the words "selling out" in years.
Yeah, that's right. Nobody talks about that anymore. Yeah, that's gone. Gone, my friend. But there's another way in which there's a contradiction here that I think is probably unsustainable over the long run, although we're going to find out in the next decade or so, and that is that consumer society itself is I don't know how it can survive. When you dismantle the middle class, which is what is happening and has been happening for a while, you know, the whole idea of consumerism, of the consumer society, is based on middle class prosperity. You know, it's based on the New Deal, on unions, on all of those things that are now disappearing in the unequal world. I mean, the people who consume now are these, you know, it's in the yacht market, you know. That's where it's all at, Sam. The yacht market, the Cadillac market, although Cadillacs are too day class A for the people I'm talking about. They want my box, you know. And who cares about Coke versus Pepsi when the middle class doesn't matter anymore? And you see what I'm saying here?
Yes.
That this whole thing is going to, at some point, it can't go on. It has to become something else. It has to change to something else. And we were able to sustain it for years with credit cards, borrowing against houses, that kind of thing. But all that's over, you know. So I don't know how the consumer society can continue.
Well, I mean, I think that's probably a good place to.
How's that for a happy note?
Yes, a good place to end on. I mean, maybe, but I'm not convinced that that's not a happy note in some respects, because, you know, I think there's a lot of evidence. You know, I'm going to be talking to someone tomorrow who makes the case that, in many respects, it's killing us.
Yeah.
I mean, just the inequality and the sort of what it creates in terms of the need to consume and the need to make more to consume is literally one of the biggest factors in actually our mortality rate. But
there you go.
Thomas Frank, always a pleasure. The book is Conquest of Cool. Let's link to that one today at majority.fm. Thomas, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
The pleasure is mine, Sam.
Talk to you soon. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and then head into the fun half of the program. Do we have any sound? We don't have any sound today.
No sound today.
We're going to have to do a random rush.
I got to say, I think the roles have been reversed. I think this first half might have been the fun half today.
Really?
That was one of the most fun interviews we've ever had. I loved hearing about counterculture and punk rock and stuff like that.
Well, there you go.
Good times.
Really? Matt's still riding a high off of that that beer opening sound effect. I will tell you this. In the better half of the program, I have the updated version of what I know all of you are going to want as a ringtone, and we are now working on the technology to actually sell our first ringtone. which is the remix of the Hey, 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 Shut Up, with added bonus value. Don't tip it.
No, I was going to say it's going to go right up on the top of the sales chart up there with the hamster dance and the crazy frog yakety yak ringtones.
I'm not familiar with the ringtone market at this moment.
Those were the big ringtones during the peak of the ringtone market.
Well, this is going to bust doors on that one. We've had our marketing and our ad agencies working on this for quite some time. So we're going to take a break. Folks, you can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. Housekeeping, tomorrow will be Matt and Mike Monday on a Wednesday. Matt and Mike Wednesday. Mark Ames will be on the program. And I will be back on Thursday. Folks, if you don't have the money to become a member, but you want access to the extra 50 minutes bonus that we give folks who become members, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We don't want to lock anybody out for finances. If you are someone who can't afford to become a member and you're not even interested in the extra material, I don't know why you wouldn't be, but some folks only have like a 40-minute commute. This is what they want to do. You can support the program anyways by becoming a member and ensure its existence and its growth, both in its reach and its quality. Yes. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, the very least, go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, buy your crap through there. We get a kickback. That's why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Great coffee. Much cheaper than going out and buying it at Starbucks. You can get it ground or in bean form. Bunch of different flavors. Fair trade. You can get organic if you want. 10% coupon code majority gets you 10% off. Get the app at majorityapp.com.
Subscribe to us on YouTube at youtube.com/Sam Cedar. We've been putting up some YouTube exclusives like Michael's Everything You Need to Know in 3 Minutes segment.
Yeah, those are going gangbusters-ish. All right. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hey.